Morning, friends. Among my favorite biblical stories is the story of Jesus' encounter with the man with the withered hand. Most of you know it, I'm sure, but let me remind you by reading the story and the run-up to it from Matthew's Gospel, the 12th chapter, verses 1 to 14. Moreover, let's try to take the advice of the 19th century Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, and hear in the story, not a familiar tale whose outcome we know, and through which we can therefore yawn, nor as an arcane tale from an antiquated book whose relevance is passé, but let us hear it as if we had been contemporary witnesses, as an ideological struggle, as a power play, as a matter of life and death, as a moment of the highest drama. It happened then that Jesus passed through the cornfields on the Sabbath day. His disciples were hungry and began picking the ears of wheat and eating them, but the Pharisees saw them do it. "There, you see," they remarked to Jesus, "your disciples are doing what the law forbids them to do on the Sabbath. Haven't you read that what David did when he and his companions were hungry?" replied Jesus. "How he went into the house of God and ate the presentation loaves, which he and his followers were not allowed to eat, since only the priests can do it? Haven't any of you read in the law that every Sabbath day, priests in the temple can break the Sabbath and yet remain blameless? I tell you, there is something more important than the temple here. If you had grasped the meaning of the scripture, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have been so quick to condemn the innocent, for the Son of Man is master even of the Sabbath." Leaving there, he went into their synagogue, where there happened to be a man with a shriveled hand. "Is it right to heal anyone on the Sabbath?" they asked him, hoping to bring a charge against him. "If any of you had a sheep which fell into a ditch on the Sabbath day, would he not take hold of it and pull it out?" replied Jesus. "How much more valuable is a man than a sheep? You see, it is right to do good on the Sabbath day." Then Jesus said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He did stretch it out, and it was restored as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and held a meeting against Jesus and discussed how they could get rid of him altogether. This story is among my favorites because Jesus here is at his radical best, in the two senses of that term radical that I hope to highlight in these lectures. For while he does attempt to justify himself, claiming for his precedence the superstars of Jewish history and the stalwarts of Jewish religious life, Jesus here clearly does break the law, defiantly, and we know in retrospect the risks involved in doing so, as surely he himself, along with the others present, must have known at the time too. Jesus here is knowingly tugging on Superman's cape, spitting into the wind, pulling the mask on the old Lone Ranger. Jesus is no idiot and no innocent. He is a keen reader of his times, and he knows full well that his message of gracious justice will provoke the ire and the opposition to the point of violence of those who are benefiting from the existing system of ungracious justice. In the face of this intimidation, of this peril, Jesus doesn't flinch. Against the imposition of an oppressive order, against the stoning of an adulterer in the name of God, against the intricately structured temple economy, Jesus preaches setting the prisoner free, giving all that one has to the poor, and the remission of sins. For those of us who want a radical gospel, an anarchistic and even revolutionary one, a courageous over against opposition to the powers that be that defies convention come what may, here is our Jesus. I love this Jesus. This Jesus is one of the main reasons I continue to call myself a Christian, despite the fact that far too often, even perhaps most of the time, the dangerous name Christian has been commandeered by precisely the forces that Jesus here defies. That the irony of Pharisaical Christians is lost on Pharisaical Christians, that is, on most of us, that this oxymoronic reality is not recognized as such, has to be one of the great mysteries and disappointments of the Christian era. And we Quakers have not been immune to this seduction. We too have our rules, insist on their purity, allow them to decide who is in and who is out, and enforce them too often with self-righteous enthusiasm. But Jesus would have none of it. He wouldn't put up with much of our nonsense either. Most of us probably wouldn't like him much. Still, this Jesus is one of the reasons I continue to call myself a Christian. Not because I share his courage, but because I wish I did. But Jesus is more than brave and defiant here. He is also wise. And his response to the challenge put to him, while no doubt brave and defiant, is also deeply nuanced. Jesus is no innocent, but neither is he a wrecking ball. He is not out to destroy anything. For entirely in breaking the law, and he does break it, Jesus also claims to be keeping it. As we have seen, in doing so, he claims to be following in the footsteps of the paradigmatic figures of the Judaic tradition, whose actions, based upon their status as honored patriarchs, everyone would recognize as lawful. His attempts to justify himself are something like evoking case law over against statutes. That David, Israel's venerated erstwhile king, broke the law too and wasn't considered a lawbreaker counts. So notice that Jesus is not simply introducing something new, something without precedent. He is not opposing Judaism, but calling it to its truest and best self, by calling his Jewish listeners to a radical revisioning of Judaism based on a dynamic found within Judaism itself, indeed at some of its richest and founding moments. It is this dynamic, traced from Judaism, through Christianity, across early Quakerism, and into our day, that I am investigating in these lectures. But more on that anon. So Jesus neither merely follows the law, nor does he merely defy it. He is neither a legalist nor an anarchist. The Bible has a term for this nuanced relationship to the law that is neither obedience nor defiance, or is perhaps at once both obedience and defiance. Where defiance is a certain kind of obedience, and where obedience requires a certain defiance. We find this term in its most straightforward usage in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus claims, "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Allow me to call your attention to this idea of fulfilling the law. Among the things that will occupy me in these lectures is contemplating what this term fulfilling might mean, and its potential importance to us as the body of contemporary friends. My suggestion will be that Quakerism is at its best in replicating the pattern set by Jesus, when it is neither legalist nor anarchist, but strives toward fulfillment. We'll get to that. But we must go back to the story to pick up some threads first. This story is complicated because it is not simply the case that the Pharisees are on the side of the establishment and Jesus is the radical outsider. The Pharisees are themselves the radicals, well, of a certain kind. The mark of the Pharisees was their insistent opposition to any hypocrisy, which, as it does in any society, set them outside of the mainstream and opposed to the powers. against the Sadducees, who controlled the temple and collaborated with the Romans, the Pharisees and their learned leaders, the scribes, were the principled idealists of their age, who were offended at the half-hearted compromises and pragmatic power of the Sadducees, of the establishment. They remind us of both fundamentalist extremists and early Quakers. There are, moreover, plenty of Pharisees among us Quakers today, both on the Orthodox and the liberal sides, those who are uncompromising in their principles and who work tirelessly, honorably, and admirably to apply those principles in ever broader contexts and in ever more exacting ways, whether those principles be the Apostle Paul's perceived advices to the churches regarding sexual purity, or an increasingly aware political correctness, or environmentalism, or in some Quaker circles, an uncompromising insistence upon an increasingly detailed application of the peace testimony to ever more minute areas of life. What I am suggesting here is that the Pharisees of Jesus' time and of our own are not so easy to write off. In fact, we shouldn't write them off at all. The Pharisees are the enthusiasts, those who take up a cause and mean it, take it seriously, and work to see it through. They are good people, admirable people. They are the ones who mean what the rest of us say, and we need them. These are the folks we name to our committees. Moreover, in reading this story, we should be aware not only that the Pharisees were well-meaning and zealous of good works, but the Sabbath law that they defended was, and I am tempted to add is, a law well worth protecting and enforcing. Far from being the arbitrary imposition of restrictions intended to cordon off a sacred time of the week reserved for an arrogant God jealous of worship and attention, the Sabbath law rather serves the most practical and most important of social ends. Against the avarice of the wealthy and powerful who might, if allowed, force the poor, who have little say in the matter, into relentless labor, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, the Sabbath law is a stop. It is a way of building rest for the poor and powerless against their oppressors into the very social fabric, based on the model of God resting from creative labors on the seventh day. The Sabbath law is a social structure designed to curb exploitation. The poor may not be worked to death. Everybody gets some R&R for God's sake, for their own sake, thanks to God. The Sabbath law brings life where there was death. And what better day than to worship God who both models and commands such rest? The Sabbath law illustrates the sacred in the best sense of something set apart. A day set apart for the leisure of those who need it most. A day not able to be violated by the agendas of wealth and power. That's what it means, as the 8th of the 10 commandments puts it. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. There tends to be a difference of interpretation around the origin, and thus the meaning, of such good laws. The more orthodox interpretation is that God reveals the law directly, rather in the manner that the law was delivered to Moses on Mount Sinai, literally out of the blue, ready-made. And it is meaningful because it has been given by God, independently of us, and whose wisdom we discover after the fact across acts of blind obedience to it. The more liberal view is that we, across our own experience, discover what is good, and after the fact attribute the wisdom as having come from God, as a way of enforcing and backing up our discoveries with divine approval. We are so sure of the righteousness of this formulation that we label it as a leading from God, as if it came directly from God. In the first interpretation, we relinquish responsibility for the law, claiming that it is out of our hands, to be blindly obeyed, which is always at once both noble and dangerous. In the second, we perhaps hubristically take the law into our own hands, make it solely our own, which not only makes it relative in the bad sense, but also places it too firmly upon the worldly wisdom that our Quaker forebears so distrusted, and perhaps justifiably. Part of what I am hoping to suggest in these lectures is that in a spiritual religion like Quakerism, we are best to reject this forced choice, this either-or. If we live with and in the power of God, as the early Quakers might have put it, the distinction is meaningless. God need not intervene as if from the outside, because God is already here, working in and through us. The outside is already inside, and the inside already outside. That there is that of God in everyone means that God is not elsewhere, but, insofar as we attend to this seed, already with us, which is what the name Emmanuel means, and which is why early Quakers preached, fiercely and fearlessly, the inward Christ. But leaving aside the questions of the origin of its origin for the moment, let us reflect on the fact, necessary to reading the story well, I think, that the Sabbath law is a good law. It does precisely what the law at its best is supposed to do. The Sabbath law is precisely the kind of thing that Quakers both have and presently should desire, campaign for, enforce, respect, even love. Thank God for the Sabbath law, especially if you're poor. Our elimination in the last decades of what were once called blue laws, in the face of consumerist and corporate pressures, means that many a single mother spends Sunday afternoons behind a jewelry counter rather than in the park with her kids on a day when they are home from school. Of course, in our economy, this Sunday job might well be better than no job at all. Children need to spend Sunday afternoons in the park with their moms, but they also need to eat and be clothed, so nothing is simple. That's what Jesus sees here, too. Rather than accusing the single mother who works Sundays with violating Sabbath, as the Pharisees would have, Jesus would indict the system that forced her into this violation. Where the Pharisees enforced submission to the law, Jesus sought redemption, not from the law, but through it. The irony here is that somehow the Pharisees, with all of their righteous enthusiasm, and I'm not being sarcastic here, their enthusiasm really was righteous, got things profoundly wrong. What Jesus gets here, and we get too, insofar as we sympathize with his actions, is that the Sabbath is all about rest and recreation, rest and recreation. The recreation of the withered hand is precisely the point of the Sabbath. Jesus has to violate the law in order to keep the law. This is the dynamic relationship to the law that is neither obedience nor disobedience, but, I am suggesting, is named by the biblical word fulfillment. One way of thinking about this is as an appeal to a higher law. The Sabbath law, that is, might be taken as one particular instantiation of the higher law of, say, neighbor love, instituted at a social level. Jesus, it might be said, attends to this higher law, whereas the Pharisees are blinded to the higher law by getting hung up on one particular and partial expression of it, losing the higher in the lower, missing the forest for the trees. But then why not encourage and live neighbor love, and Sabbath will take care of itself? This latter gives us the anarchist's impulse, and there is something profoundly right about that. The 4th century church father, Augustine, though far from an anarchist on very many axes, gives us the classical expression of this impulse with his distillation of Christian ethics, Diliga et quod vis fac, love and do what you please. That's not bad advice. Would that more of us would learn it and live it. But we also know that love without justice is a mere wisp in the wind. Love is nothing if it is not concretized in the world, if it does not take shape in this structure or that. If someone says, I love you, but that love does not take concrete form in the world, it is, in other biblical language, but as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Love is itself not a law, not itself a concrete form, but the motivation for the law, what calls us to construct good laws that protect, in the language of the Hebrew Scriptures, the stranger, the widow, and the orphan. The law of love is an oxymoron. True love is never an obligation, although there is no true love without obligations. It is because love motivates the law, takes shape in the law, but nevertheless is not the law, that the law can become empty, hollowed out, a mere form, loveless, an impediment to healing and wholeness rather than its vehicle. Justice brags of being blind, which is a good thing when it signifies impartiality, but disastrous when it means not seeing the faces of those upon whose weight it falls. For then we get Sabbath without recreation. Then we get not a day of rest, but a day of wrath. Then we get no Sabbath at all, just the law, but the law without justice. The law is the body of love, love's concrete presence in the world. But the body of law, not animated by love, is a dead weight, a corpse, which is why we need the police, but are so hesitant to call them. The relationship between the law that love requires and the way in which love must always transcend the law is a complicated one. Love takes shape, realizes itself in the world across structures like the law. But love remains irreducible to those structures, goes beyond the law. Love judges the law, even as the law is the very reality of love in the world. The law without love is empty. Love without the law is impotent. If Orthodox friends major in neighbor love as a correlate of the love of God, as per Matthew 22, sometimes to the diminishment of a concern for justice, liberal friends accentuate justice, often to the detriment of neighbor love. Of course, the Orthodox want justice, and of course, liberals are motivated by love, so those are blatant and rather unfair overgeneralizations, but not without some basis in reality for that. If love and the law are interdependent, as I am arguing, then you can never have one without the other. But you can accentuate one of the terms to the point of eclipsing its correlate, to the point of perversion. One of the things I hope to propose in these lectures is that perhaps Quakers of very different orientations have something yet to learn from each other. So what does it mean to fulfill the law? It means to go beyond the law without destroying it or leaving it behind. Fulfilling means to go beyond while remaining within, both at once. Unlike our colloquial usage whereby the fulfillment of an obligation means that I no longer have it, the biblical sense of fulfillment deepens our obligations, but in a manner that transforms them. In the Sermon on the Mount, following shortly upon his claim that he has come not to abolish but fulfill the law, Jesus ratchets up the law by engaging in a series of sayings that take the form of, "You have heard it said one thing, but I say unto you something else. Thus you have heard it said of men of old, you shall not kill. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." Fulfillment here means not that I am now no longer required to love my neighbor, or that I no longer need to be faithful to my spouse, or that I'm allowed to kill anybody. But neither does it simply mean that I am still to do the first, but something else in addition to. In fulfillment, the relationship with the law is itself transformed. In Quaker terms, we might say that the law is no longer something outer to be obeyed, whether I like it or not, but that it becomes something inner. And this fits with the Old Testament ideal that the law is not some alienating code, but is to be inscribed on the heart, or internalized in the language of modern psychology. The law fulfilled is a matter of the heart. If we don't have a heart for those whom the law serves, we might obey, but will never fulfill the law. The point here is not to obey the law, although obeying the law is still required, but to be transformed by it, be made over in its image, which is what Quakers historically have referred to as sanctification or holiness. Indeed, early Quakers, and many Orthodox Quakers to this day, put a stress on holiness, meaning being sinless. Liberal Quakers often have an aversion to the word sin, as in our culture, it has taken on a Victorian aura of personal moral impurity that offends our humanist sensibilities. But the biblical term sin, hamartia, simply means missing the mark. And liberal friends certainly believe that at least some people miss the mark on a rather regular basis. Just listen to them talk about politics for a while. So perhaps this early Quaker experience need not be foreign to liberals either. In holiness, I no longer run up against the law. Rather, my actions conform to the law as flowing from a transformed self, one enlightened by Christ. Against the Puritans of the day, whom the Quakers accused of preaching up sin, that is, who taught that Christ's act of atonement was sufficient to forgive my sins, even as I remained a wretched sinner, the Quakers maintained that Christ's act of atonement effectively eliminated my sin. If I couldn't be sinless, that is, if Christ's atonement left sin in place, that, they thought, was an anemic forgiveness. And many an early friend went to prison for the blasphemy of claiming to have been transformed to the point of perfect obedience to the law, of being a very participant in the life of Christ, of claiming to be, in their phrase, a son of God. To fulfill the law means to fill it up, but fill it to overflowing, like the biblical promise of an abundant life of cups running over. The Greek word for fulfill, pleroo, has among its meanings in the New Testament not only to render full, to complete, and to render perfect, but also to pervade and to abound. Fulfillment is excessive, violating all borders, exploding all boundaries, but flowing from the same source. The law is binding, but can, for that very reason, keep us in bondage. The law frees us. The Sabbath law emancipates the poor from the curse of endless labor. Even as we are only free insofar as we are freed from the law, insofar as love so fills the law that the law itself cannot contain it. In a strange sort of way, fulfillment makes even the law obey the law. If the Sabbath law, designed for recreation, prohibits recreation, it is, even if kept, in violation of itself, and must, as fulfilled, be broken in order to be kept, which is what the Pharisees, in their myopic focus on the law, couldn't see. It is this dynamic of fulfillment, of forms that give positive and concrete shape to life and love, even as they cannot contain life and love, that I want to investigate this week, exploring its implications for the ways in which we might understand ourselves as Quakers today.